Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I'm so excited today to bring you Michael Tracy. Michael is a Vashon Island musicologist, and I hope today he'll even tell us what a musicologist is. For me, he's been someone who's out in front bringing us great music along with great music history through his lectures at the Performance Hall, VCA, and even formerly on this radio station where he was doing a program during the pandemic so that we could all keep our music history going. But as Michael has been talking to us about the great composers of the world, he's said very little about himself. So today's my day to ask him questions and find out who is Michael Tracy, what is a musicologist, and I have a few other questions up my sleeve. So thank you so much for joining.
Oh, this is fun. So thank you for inviting me and look forward to talking.
And before we formally pushed record, you were talking about your education, your background, your years in New York. So roll it back. Did you always want to be a musician? What was your relationship to music growing up?
My relationship to music was within my family. My mother played the piano and sang, and I'm from a family of six children. And typically on a Friday, Saturday evening, we would all get around the piano and sing the songs from Broadway, such as from South Pacific, My Fair Lady, Oklahoma, as well as my mother had music from Gershwin, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin. And so that was the beginning of our exposure to music. And at the age of seven, I started taking piano lessons with my older sister. And I just fell in love with the piano and music and had this dream of, oh, gee, wouldn't it be lovely to be a concert pianist and play with an orchestra.
Now, where were you living again?
I was raised in Atlanta, Georgia. And sort of back then, it was not on the music scene much at all. It didn't even have the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in the late 50s when I was just starting. But I had a really lovely piano teacher. She was from Italy and gave me a true love of music. At the age of 14, it was sort of decided that it'd be better for me to spend my afternoons playing football rather than taking piano lessons.
When you say it was decided, who was the it?
Well, it was basically my older brother and my mother, probably my older brother. and also, the family was in sort of very tight financial situation because my father died when I was 10, leaving my mother with six children. And fortunately, they had bought a lot of life insurance since his first heart attack he experienced when he was 33. So it was also just sort of financial reasons that maybe piano is a little bit extravagant. But I continued playing on my own, picking up pieces of music like Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and teaching myself. And it was after spending 6 months working in Munich, Germany after high school that I just said, oh, I've got to try this. I just have to. And I was going to Georgia State University.
And it was that performance that you wanted to try?
Yeah, I wanted to try to be a performing pianist. And Georgia State University had a music school, and I had to audition, and I got in. And as an insurance policy, very much from the suggestion of my mother. I also pursued a degree in economics in the business school. So by the time I graduated, I had two degrees, one in music and one in economics, but one was in the arts and science school, the other was in the business school. So
that's a great way to hedge your bets, though.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm very glad I did, because originally I wanted to be a concert pianist. Quickly, though, after my second year in the music school, I realized how far behind I was. I mean, there were pianists already winning competitions at the age of 16, and here I was 20, 21, just learning the literature. But it gave me a period of, you know, 3-4 years where I practiced like 8 hours a day and built up a really good technique and knowledge of the piano that I still have with me today. So it paid off.
Was it hard to come to that moment of truth when you knew you weren't going to be a concert pianist?
That's a good question. I can't remember it really being that much of a tragedy, because I saw how hard it was for my colleagues who were far, far ahead of me in their knowledge of the piano and performance and career. And it was so difficult for them. And, you know, let's be realistic. This is Atlanta, Georgia. This is not New York City. This is not London. This is not Moscow, where you have some of the greatest pianists in training. I still didn't know what I wanted to do. After college, I went to go.
But you did a degree in musicology, didn't you? Was
yeah.
that later? Or
yeah,
is that
in the music school, you sort of specialize. A lot of the students in the music school were specializing in education to be a music teacher in schools. There was a performance degree, but I chose to get the musicology degree. And I love history. I've always been fascinated with history. And basically, that's what musicology is. It's the history and analysis of music. So you not only learn about the music, you learn about the composer who wrote it and who he was influenced by, what was his style, who did he influence, and also the different ways music was performed from one century to the next.
All the things that you bring to us in your lectures at Vashon Center for the Arts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Realizing at the period of Michelangelo, there's hardly anything like an orchestra. It's all choir and basically church music. By the end of the 16th century, you had the beginning of opera. By the beginning of the 18th century, you start having small symphonies and obviously big choral works like Bach with full orchestra. And then by the 19th century, you have what we consider the modern world of music with Beethoven, Haydn, Schubert starting off the 19th century.
And so when you were getting this degree, when you're specializing in musicology, was your thought to become a professional musicologist, which seems to be a long road that requires a doctorate and, you know, specialization and things like that?
Yeah, I had, through my mother and other members of the family, I had quite a number of family friends who were professors at Emory, Georgia State University, Georgia Tech. And I saw that it was not necessarily the nirvana that we often think of the academia life. It has its own sort of ruthless competition, and also just the opportunities of jobs and a career in musicology is quite limited. And so it was a pretty easy decision to say, okay, let's try the business world.
I see. Well, and a really smart one, because when you're pushed into specialization through a doctorate and all, and you're in that highly politicized academy, you can lose some of your love for music and music history. Whereas when you keep it as something that's yours, that you do because you love and you make your money somewhere else, there's a chance that that love can continue longer.
You are so right. And I saw that, especially living in New York City, where I ended up after living in Europe for a number of years. I had a lot of friends who were graduates from Juilliard, Eastman School of Music, New England Conservatory, excellent, excellent musicians with a budding career. But it is very interesting, though, then to run across somebody who, let's say, is playing in a Broadway orchestra. I had a friend who played in a Broadway orchestra for Phantom of the Opera. He played the harp, and he played the same piece of music for over 30 years of his life, every single night, except for one day when they'd be off. And some days, Sunday, you are doing it twice. And this is where they come up with, it's a German word called Geschäft, which means work. It's no longer your spirit reacting to the emotional content of the music. No, it's just getting through the job. And yeah, it really affects your love and appreciation of the music when you have to do it because it's going to pay the rent.
Wow. Well, I'm thinking about your path, and it's really interesting to me because you have this tremendous empathy for performers, and you know what they've gone through, and also the challenges. And you've had resources from your hard work in investment banking or investment management or
investment management. We call them financial consultants, handling the finances of individuals.
I see. So, in a way, you were really set up to be a leading supporter of the arts because you understood. And you had resources, and you also had exposure to the business world to know how things worked.
Yeah, and I started doing this when I was living in New York City. By 1991, I got a loft in the Chelsea area of Manhattan, a really nice, good-sized loft with very high ceilings. And so I was hosting house concerts, let's say for 30 to 40 people. And in New York City, you have no problem finding great musicians who want to perform. And so it'd be a joint affair. The musicians would invite their friends. I would invite my friends. But my main purpose was to expose people who had never heard this music live before, or maybe had never heard it, period. For example, the art songs of Schubert and Schumann and Debussy, which are rarely, rarely done in a public venue. But, you know, to see people's reaction when they hear the Rachmaninoff cello sonata right in front of them and they hear the vibration of the cello strings in their bones, it makes the music so much accessible. And to me, it's such a joy to, like, open up this treasure chest of fantastic music to people who've never experienced it.
That's incredible. I study with an artist who's always saying, you have to go to a museum. You have to see these pieces live, you know, with your eyes, because as great as a computer can be and sharing resources, it won't be the same as having the experience of being next to the work. Well, you're doing the equivalent with music, except that with music, you also have the vibratory piece that you actually vibrate with the music mm-hmm. in a way that you just can't replicate when you're listening to your CD or driving around.
People who are very big into sound systems will immediately talk about the difference between analog and digital sound quality. And that's why it's so astounding when people go, like, for example, into Kay White Hall and hear this live sound, this analog sound, that it's so much richer, so much of a visceral experience. And the more intimate the setting, then we have to realize that I would say close to 80% of music that's written was written for a room, a small venue, not the big concert halls. I mean, big concert halls just started to happen sporadically towards the end of the 1700s. But the time of the big orchestra and symphonies in big cities really was not part of the music scene till 1840s, 1850s.
That's amazing. I didn't ever think about that, and it would suggest that the kind of venue influences the kind of music that gets produced, and those beautiful art songs and smaller orchestral pieces, you know, where do they go now? You
know? Exactly. And for example, Schubert wrote over 600 songs. Now, and they are one after the other, just amazing, amazing music. I mean, the best one we know is, of course, the Ave Maria by Schubert. But then all the chamber music, where you have two violins, a viola, and a cello, and that's it. Now, you hear that in a big hall, it's really hard to concentrate and keep with the music. You are in a small room with about 30 other people, you'll get it. The same thing with singing. I mean, even, for example, opera, which is for the big stage, but the typical opera house in Italy seated about 300 people, maybe 600. Now, that's about the size of Kay White Hall. So even then, opera was still quite an intimate experience.
Yeah. So interesting, because now we have music that's created for the multitudes, you know, the Freddie Mercury, you know, Queen on Stage, the Edinburgh Festival, thousands and thousands and thousands, but that can never house the kind of music that you're talking about.
No, it's a completely different experience. And that's why my sort of mission here on Vashon, because I will host house concerts at my place every now and then, but also, you know, I'm curating the piano series at Kay White Hall. And it's really to bring people back to this intimate, visceral experience. You can take anybody off the street and have them listen to a live cello sound and then play them a CD or, you know, digital recording, and they'll immediately hear the difference. It's like so much is lost. I mean, it's great we can access this music, you know, digitally. I mean, it's so... I mean, you and I remember, you know, hitting the turntable and scratching the one record that didn't have a scratch on it, and et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, and it can only afford two or three of those because that's what you could do. And listening to WQXR in Manhattan, because they had weren't they the classical music station?
Yes.
And had a repertoire, but still being very limited. And It's a side note for me, because I'm very interested in the sound and music as healing modalities. And you're also making me think that the sound of that cello that's vibrating live enters your body differently and probably has different healing properties than a wonderful recording that you can hear but won't quite vibrate the same way.
I don't have any children, so I haven't raised a baby and things like that. But, you know, the typical thing of a mother singing to her child, I have friends who are a cellist and they do the same thing with their young child. And yeah, it has a very calming, very therapeutic effect. There's no doubt about it. Even you can see documentaries about people who have very severe Alzheimer's. Have really lost, you know, complete consciousness of what's around them. And there's one, it's a retirement home in Milan for retired opera singers. And it was set up by Giuseppe Verdi. And this documentary shows this, you know, the residents sitting there, and all at once they start to play this aria. And this woman stands up who is not talking to anybody in years, and sings her aria. And it brings tears to your eyes.
I can feel it. I can feel it.
There's a connection that nobody can make except music.
Yes. 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 You were, well, first let me just let people know that I'm Sally Fox, and I'm talking to Michael Tracy, a musicologist and great backer of the arts on Vashon Island. Given your world in New York, where you were with the epicenter of so much culture, and you were also able to offer culture through your salons and all, what brought you to Vashon?
Well, a typical Easterner, I had no idea of, you know, the states of Oregon and Washington. Typical Easterner, once you get past Chicago, there's Denver, then there's L.A. and San Francisco, then that's it. Oh, and there's Alaska, that big thing up in the north. But my sister and her husband, both teachers, moved from Brooklyn, New York to West Seattle in 1991. And every summer I was coming out here doing wilderness camping with them. They're big campers, big kayakers. And so I just fell in love with the beauty of the Northwest and, you know, the beauty of Seattle, and with quite a vibrant culture scene. And it was around 2010 that I noticed people in my office wouldn't be there for like 6 months of the year. And so I asked, like, where are they? I mean, don't they have to come? Well, they're working remotely from their home in L.A. I thought, like, whoa, okay. So if I did leave New York, I wouldn't have to necessarily live in another big city. I could maybe live out in the country. So that opened up a lot of possibilities. And things were happening in New York, which made me think, like, oh, maybe this isn't the place you will want to retire. I had grown up in Atlanta around trees and a lot of vegetation. And people always said, oh, get your weekend house, you know, in the country outside New York. Well, as a single person, that's a nightmare. I mean, there's always been something to do over the weekend to keep that second house in repair. So once I figured out that I could work remotely full time from my home, that gave me the possibility of living in a place outside a city. And with Zillow, you can look at all the available properties. I knew nothing about the different neighborhoods here. I did spend 2 days in Bainbridge because everybody in New York said that's the place to go. But Bainbridge came across to me more like moving to Westchester, like Scarsdale, you know, very upscale suburb. And on a wet Friday morning, my sister and I left West Seattle, drove on to Vashon, and it was stopping off at Minglement, getting a cup of coffee, and then asking a woman at the counter, her name was Anna, do you know any good birding spots? And she immediately pulled out the Vashon magazine, showed me the map, came back into the car, and I said to my sister, this is it. This is it. And I was also extremely lucky that I found a property, originally 17 acres, now 27 acres, which has some of the most pristine forest of Vashon. So it's like, I mean, I walk outside my door in the morning and I cannot believe how good my fate has been to not only land on Vashon, but also to be living on this fantastic piece of property.
And you didn't miss the vibrant cultural life that you had in New York City?
Yeah, it's one thing almost everybody asks, and I sort of wonder to myself, like, why do I not feel this void? And for one thing, there is a lot going on culturally on Vashon, but I had seen and experienced so much that wasn't what was missing in my life. What was missing in my life was a sense of nature, a sense of peace, also a sense of community. And this is the thing that also sort of decided for me to leave New York, is that, like, after every 5 or 6 years, you are having to build a whole new group of friends, because it's a very mobile city. Everything's changing constantly. And so to find some more of a permanence was more important to me than going to the latest Broadway or the latest opera production. And so, no, I have no sense of any kind of void, you know, from leaving
great.
New York City.
Yeah, well, lucky Vashon that we won you in that sense. I'm talking to Michael Tracy, a musicologist and great supporter of the arts here on Vashon Island. This is Sally Fox and Embracing the Muse. Talk about your relationship with Vashon Center for the Arts, because over the years, you have done an amazing series of lectures. You were part of the Talks on the Rock, and even before it was Talks on the Rock, you were introducing us to often pianists and talking about different parts of music history. And I always thought, how do you have that larger repertoire that you can go from the Spanish to Chopin to Rachmaninoff, you know, and all the different eras that you've covered over time, Debussy. How did that relationship start? And then how are you able to bring in so much?
Very good friends of mine were members of the board of the Vashon Center for the Arts and had been to some of my house concerts. And actually, I think one of the directors of the Vashon Center of the Arts had attended a house concert and said, you know, would you be willing to do this? And I never had, you know, done a lecture before like this. But whenever I hosted house concerts, I'd always either myself or have the musicians explain the music, talk about the composer, especially if it's a song, make sure people understand the lyrics so that they have a knowledge of what they're going to listen. And I just knew that if part of my goal looking at the new Center for the Arts in the fantastic Kay White Hall is that, you know, part of is to build an audience. And how do you build an audience? But you expose them to this music. And instead of just talking theoretically about how this music is composed and how it's structured, bring people into the lives, which I've always found fascinating. I mean, for example, Beethoven lived in the Habsburg Empire, which had no copyright. So when he wrote the Fifth Symphony, he only got paid one time from the publisher. After that, all future printings, all future performances gave no remuneration back to Beethoven. So, of course, he had just to keep on writing. And so it's that knowledge of, you know, how a musician supported himself, how the music was heard. It's always an eye opener when people realize that it only was the beginning of the 20th century that we could actually hear music artificially, you know, a recording. It always had to be live. Thus the importance of the piano. The piano was really the first time the middle class could have live music in their home. And of course we see it with all the songs that became popular in the 19th century from Stephen Foster and others. So the introduction of the piano became very economical. You could buy a small piano, middle class family could have one. So for example, in Paris around 1850, had a population of about over a million, had over 60,000 pianos in Paris. It was sort of like the Walkman of its day. And so I find giving people that perspective, they can sort of then relate better to the music. And
it makes it come alive, and it also it takes it away from that sort of effete place where music is for, you know, artists, intellectuals who kind of understand classical music, to something that everybody can enjoy, that was never meant for just the elite. But
no, exactly. The one of the main points of I told V VCA when I was going to do these lectures is that I wanted to have live performers, because that was part of the experience, is having people hear actual live music in that hall. And I think that made a huge difference. And unfortunately, I found an incredible talented pianist in Seattle, Mark Salmon, who, you know, if he wished, could have a huge international career, but obviously he much rather spend time with his family in Seattle, teach in Seattle, and live a normal life, and pursue music on his own terms. But it's not every day you find somebody who can play by memory all 32 Beethoven sonatas. That's over 12 hours of music.
And is willing to take the ferry and come over on a Sunday afternoon to do a lecture with you.
He himself can speak so well music. So we will share the stage.
How did you know him?
I just found him on YouTube.
Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah. I just did a search saying Seattle pianist playing Chopin or Seattle pianist playing Liszt. And yeah, you see names pop up, you listen to them, and you say, well, no, not that one. Nope, not that one. Oh, that's not quality. And then... wow.
Oh, my.
This is an amazing talent.
And then you began to bring, weren't you the one who brought Slava?
Yes.
What's his full name, just for people?
It's Slava Gryaznov.
Yeah. How did you find him?
The same way. When I started the lecture series, then I was asked, well, we really don't have anybody on staff who knows anything about classical music. Would you be willing to find, you know, pianists that we can hire? And of course, the budget's very limited. I mean, the big names would cost you $15,000-$20,000 for a single night. And, you know, there's no way a VCA has that kind of budget. So I knew it had to be an up-and-coming talent, maybe who had won a competition or had really just done a new recording. And so it was really up to me to decide, is this really a good enough talent to bring here? And there's certain pieces of music that really will show me if the pianist is emotionally there with his music and really trying to say something and not just a technical wizard, because a technical wizard gets really boring, and that's not what I wanted to happen to the audience here. And I must say, it's luck that Slava was the first person I brought.
Amazing, because I assume that you had a long time connection, and instead you were doing your own research, but you knew great music when you heard it, so you could tell a talent.
Yeah, there are so many qualified pianists, you know, who can play the huge literature and get all the notes correct, and just leave you bored. And so it takes a lot of listening. You tend to pick a piece that you know yourself very well, and see how they interpret it. And, so I would say every pianist who has come here is an exceptional talent.
Can you give us a little vignette about, are there four pianists that you're bringing in this year? Aren't there in the VCA? Just a sentence or two about each one, why we could be excited.
Well, the first one this year was Albert Cano Schmidt, mm-hmm. who had been here before. A young pianist from Barcelona originally, studying at Juilliard. He won the Naumburg competition. Albert has one of the most incredibly sensitive touches and expression with his music I've ever heard from a person his age. Usually, pianists don't play like that until they're in their 60s, because, you know, it takes life experience. And then Slava does his piano fit, but that's Slava's organization.
Yes.
You know, it's completely under his tutelage, so I don't get
that's
involved.
That's not yours,
in that.
Yeah.
The next pianist is Cole Anderson. He's from the Seattle area. He actually at one time studied with Mark Salmon, and they're very close friends. He's coming in early September. He'll be playing a fantastic set of pieces by Ravel called La Miroir, which is just incredibly, incredibly dynamic music. he was actually recommended by a patron of VCA, which we get that a lot, and I'll check them out. And if they don't make the mustard, then that's where it stays. But I was very impressed with Cole's playing. So he's coming in early September. Then Reed Tetzloff is coming in early October. He's played here before. Reed has a huge career already. I mean, playing with the top orchestras around the world. His program will end with, for me, one of the greatest works of the 19th century. It's the Liszt, Franz Liszt, B minor sonata for piano. It's about 40 minutes, and technically, to me, it's impossible. I could never imagine being able to do this. But that's not what you're supposed to be amazed with. It's just the most incredibly beautiful piece of music. So this will be a first. It's going to be a challenge for the listeners. Reed will probably give a lecture before then to explain a bit about the piece, which will help the listeners. And then December, we're having a woman originally from Indonesia, Janice Carissa. She's studying at Juilliard, actually under the same teacher that Albert Cano Smith is studying under. She got a full scholarship to Curtis Institute of Music at the age of 12. Beautiful, beautiful touch, fantastic emotional quality with her music. So yeah, those are the pianists coming up.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because already hearing them through your words, it's different than reading a brochure. Because I can sense your excitement, you know, I can sense your love of the music and also the excitement of bringing top-notch performers to bring it to us.
Yeah, and it's sort of a dream job for me. It's a great way to be spending an evening, and I generally will go to YouTube to find the next artist.
Wow. What, as we begin to wrap, what's next for Michael Tracy? How's your creative heart moving you right now? And what would you like to see in the next few years?
Well, I'd love to see, you know, more and more classical music concerts. I would love to see a art song series come about. It all has to do with budget and availability of talent. On the other side of my life is my 27 acres, which is in preservation with the county, and I have about 3 miles of trails, and it's in the Christian Creek Ravine, which has a lot of old growth still there. And so this is the sort of the other side. To me, it's very close to
I'm thinking
music.
You call it the other side, but somehow when you're walking through the creek and it's a little rainy and the birds are out, doesn't it actually seem pretty linked to music?
Yeah. I mean, many, many great composers would find inspiration by just walking through the woods and through nature. And also, it will be my legacy to the island, because in my will, this will go to the land trust, and hopefully the land trust can expand from my 27 acres, because the Christensen Creek Ravine is one of the more wild areas of Vashon.
Wait, is it in the north or near Shingleville?
No, everybody knows Liza Buella.
Uh-huh.
And that's where the Christensen Creek comes and meets Culver's Passage.
Okay.
So it's right there. The creek is all spring-fed, so there's no really headwaters for it. It is definitely that other part of my life that keeps me very motivated and very occupied.
And as I know from just owning 6 acres, the land never stays still. So there's always something that's happening that it's asking of us. So.
Oh, yeah. Trees falling, or you have to repair a trail, et cetera.
Or you find an invasive that you don't want.
yes. Yeah, the big evils, ivy, holly, and blackberry.
Yeah, on Maury, it's Lamium as well, the lovely little mint character that wants to take over Maury. So, yeah.
Oh, I don't know about that one.
Well, it's probably because you're in a different ecosystem
of where you are.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for spending time with me and allowing me to kind of go backstage with Michael Tracy, because your front stage work, your offerings, your history, bringing in the performers and doing this mix of taking us into the life of a composer while allowing us to also hear the music being performed live. It's just been incredibly rich. And I want to thank you for that as well as for your time.
Well, I'm very appreciative having the opportunity to bring this to the fantastic cultural community of Vashon. It's really, it makes my life so much fuller to be able to share my knowledge and my love of this great music. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.